Hello, my name's Guy Somerset. I'm the Books and Culture Editor of the New Zealand Listener. This is the latest of the Listener Book Club podcasts. Today we're talking to John Dawson, who last night won the Best Book Award and the Best General Non-Fiction Award for New Zealand's Native Trees in collaboration with photographer Rob Lucas. It's a big book. How many types of trees do you record in the book altogether?
A few hundred.
Yeah,
I can't think offhand exactly.
And are they all the known New Zealand natives?
Pretty well, yeah. There are some that are restricted to small offshore islands, but a lot of those are in cultivation, so photographs of cultivated forms of them, yeah.
And of the ones that you write about in the book, were you able to see personally? Did you sort of sight all of them yourself?
I think I pretty well did. I think Rob and I sort of get around together to find these things, yeah.
And what would be some of the more remote locations that would require of you?
The Sub-Antarctic Islands.
Right.
Auckland Islands, because that's the only one of them that does have actual trees.
Yeah. Yeah. There's some fine-looking specimens in the book, but I'm quite a shallow person, so I'm looking at looks only. But from your point of view, what are some of the more interesting trees that you record in the book, and what are some of the reasons why that's so?
Oh, well, the kauri, of course, is a notable big tree, one of the biggest trees in the world. So that's always very photogenic. But rimu, groups of plants that are called conifers, that they have seeds but they don't have flowers, and they're a more ancient group. And we've got about 20 such trees. 17 trees and then a few shrubby higher altitude things. And so there are not many of them, but they're very prominent because they're the big trees usually that stand high above the rest, particularly the rimu,
yeah,
which is very widely spread through the country. Yeah.
And but beyond looks, what are some of the qualities that really stand out as an as a point of interest for you in some of the specimens that you come across?
Well, I think they're imposing height. A lot of them, you sort of have a main canopy of the forest, which is often tawa, which is a flowering tree, not a conifer. And the conifers are generally taller. They stand above the roof of the forest as individuals, so they stand out more. And a lot of them have very attractive bark patterns. Whereas in the tropics where, I mean, bark is sort of protect the growing tissues within. And, of course, where you've got very cold continental winters, they need a lot of protection, very thick bark. But in tropical forests, they don't have this problem. They tend to have very thin, smooth bark. But in the cooler regions, you have some beautiful bark patterns with all kinds of lichens and so forth,
yeah,
growing on them. So, and, of course, it's easier to see the trunks than the,
yeah,
tops of the trees.
Right. And from Rob's point of view, I mean, photographing some of these aspects of the trees, was that... were there some that he had to kind of wait for the opportunity, or there's some that he was really keen to get that were difficult?
Yeah, well, some of them are easier to get at. Others with a restricted range, you get some that are, well, North Cape and so forth, or Northland. So he had to drive and find them. But I always think that the advantage for people who study plants is they don't run away and hide.
And it's a long-term presence.
Yes.
One of the things that really interested me in the book was you talk about the combination of unique biodiversity but also the connections to trees, and I'm fascinated by how once New Zealand are geographically separated from Australia and so forth, how those connections are made. I mean, how do species arrive and leave after the land separation?
Yeah, well, at one time they thought that quite a number of the species in the flora would have come with New Zealand when it separated. I think the feeling now is, from, you know, fuller information of fossils, is that probably a lot of what we've got here did jump a gap. Some things are designed for that, where birds eat them, swallow them, and excrete the seeds somewhere else. But there are other things that don't seem to have any particular ability to spread their seeds who've obviously done it. But I think it's a matter of we judge things on our own lifetime, which is not very long.
Yeah.
and we can't conceive of the lengths of time. And if something's possible, it's going to happen.
Yeah. And I think you also talk in the book about even seeds washing up on the shores elsewhere.
Yeah. So they, well, things like the coconut, of course, that gets everywhere because it can float and not damaged by seawater. And I think the coastal plants and the Pacific Island plants are the ones that have the ability to really move around as if there's no gaps at all.
So,
but mostly the plants can't readily cross wide gaps, and because there's wide gaps to everywhere in New Zealand.
Right. What, I mean, within the book, what are the newest of the natives? I mean, are you able to kind of gauge that?
I can't think of one offhand. There's one that is sort of East Coast North Island. It's pretty much the same as one in Australia, and that's suspected to be, because it wouldn't be the Maori, because I don't think they ever got to Australia.
No.
So it would be a chance on a log or something, getting across and just establishing on that one place.
And what sort of period would that have been, time-wise?
I don't know how they estimated that.
Right.
It wouldn't be very far into the past.
Right.
Maybe a few thousand years.
Yes. You obviously have a different measure of time than the rest of us in your field.
Yeah.
The other interesting thing in the book I found was the section on pollination, because it struck me that pollination is going to be a kind of very important indicator in some ways for climate change, in the sense that the time of the year that things pollinate, as climate changes, presumably the pollination times of trees will change too.
Yeah, well, most of the flowering is in the spring, so there's the summer growth period, and the minority of species are flowering in the autumn, so I don't quite know why that happens, but you always know that in the autumn, certain thing, that's when certain species flower, and they don't flower in the spring. Yes, I'm not sure about this climate change business, because the impression given is that this has never happened before, that climate has always been more or less stable. It hasn't.
Right.
There have been hundreds, if not thousands, of ups and downs in sequence. So, and then, of course, they've found, they say, all right, the CO2 is increasing, and the temperatures are increasing together, so they must be linked, and for some reason they've decided that the CO2 has caused the other. I think, well, why hasn't the other caused the CO2?
But, right.
So I'm a bit of a sceptic on
that. So, and you've not seen any changes in the term, are some trees pollinating earlier than they might have 10, 20 years ago?
You've not heard of it.
You've not seen that, noticed anything that. I love at the back of the book you have your sex expression appendix, which reminded me a little bit of the Village Voice in New York has the men seeking women, men seeking men, men ads at the back, and you have kind of CM seeking CB, you could have, or some equivalent. Yeah. It sounds like, or it looks like, that trees have a kind of rich and varied sex life.
Well, I don't think they get excited about it. But well, of course,
it's very complex and complicated one.
I mean, plants and animals are pretty similar in some ways, except that plants have the advantage they can make their own food, and animals can't do that. So we have to eat plants, and then plants have this problem of trying to keep, either make use of animals, offer them nectar so that they come and pollinate and take the seeds, or keep them at bay with spikes and kinds of things.
When did you first become interested in trees? What was it? Were you very, very young when they kind of struck your interest?
I think I was. I was born and grew up in Eketahuna. I don't know whether you've caught up with Eketahuna. It's sort of the nowhere place.
Right.
Hickstown.
It is mentioned sometimes.
Yeah. In fact, I remember once somebody said, where were you born? I said, I was born in Eketahuna. And they said, oh, does that really exist? I thought it was just made up as a joke.
I think it's actually in possibly in one of Sue Orr's short stories, I think, is said that.
There was another occasion, or a group that came, I took around, and it was from Christchurch, and one was a retired doctor, and people say, you know, where were you born, etc. So I said, I mean, you're the first person born in Eketahuna that I've ever met. Can I shake your hand?
Far more important than winning the book award.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
So, and what was it there that struck your interest in trees?
We had quite a big garden, although neither my parents were greatly interested in it. But I think I had an older brother who, and that was, I was much younger than my three older brothers, and they sort of grew up in recession times in the late 20s, 30s. And this older brother, you know, there was no jobs, so he decided to sort of do something with the garden. So he planted quite a few things. And I don't remember plants are interesting. I think I just was tuned into plants.
Yeah.
And not at that stage, not particularly native, mostly garden plants. And then Eketahuna was in what was called, some people called the 40-mile bush, and others say 70-mile bush. So it was densely forested. But, of course, at that stage, the thing was to get rid of the forest and get pasture, see. And I can, there wasn't much left when I was around, but there was some native bush, so I got interested in those. And then I just felt, well, I want to study plants in my life. And I decided I wanted to go to university, and I was the first in the family who had. And managed to do that, and did a bachelor's degree with major in botany. And then I got a Fulbright and went to the University of California at Berkeley for a PhD again in botany. And then I came back to a lectureship at the University of Wellington. This was the days when it was probably easier to get jobs then.
Yeah.
I was sort of thinking that at that time, if you had a lectureship advertised, you'd get perhaps 6 or 7 applicants, and some of them, people wouldn't even consider. And I think sometimes, as a result, a few people, weren't really impressed with any of them, and decided, well, maybe this one would be all right, and a few duds got into the system then. But now, for a lectureship, you might get 30, and you're going to get a little group that are equally good. And you can only appoint one, so it's bad in each direction of the two extremes.
You spoke there of how when you were growing up, some of the trees were being cleared, the forests were being cleared, and so forth. You take a kindly view towards the settlers of the 19th century. You don't take a kind of revisionist or the benefit of hindsight view. You kind of allow them that they were doing the best that they thought they could do.
Yeah, well, I mean, they had to feed their families, didn't they?
Yeah.
And I think they would come by ship, taking months. And I imagine there'd be a few wives who'd think, why on earth did we come to this place? And that little rough hut. And you get these photographs of that time, and there's sort of blackened trees and stumps, and not like England at all.
Home. And do you think that during those times, and before those times with the Maori, that there were many species lost of trees at all, completely?
The Maori were not as damaging as the Europeans. The Europeans had more equipment to deal with it. But I think pre-Maori, the estimate was perhaps 80% of New Zealand was forest covered. And they got rid of quite a lot of it. I think in some cases by fires that got out of control. You know, in a dry summer, particularly in the east. So they reduced it to about 50%, and now we've got it down to about 23%. Try harder.
I was going to ask, really, I mean, how are we doing now? New Zealanders profess to love their bush, but, are we treating it well?
I think there's a different attitude now. I think when I was younger, people weren't greatly interested in the bush. There was still, there's Forest and Bird, who certainly were. But it seems to me that more people are interested in the natural situation in New Zealand, and quite happy to have things reserved, except when there's gold or oil.
It's a big book, 550 pages, yes. 2,300 photographs, and a very heavy book.
Yeah,
you won't be taking it into the bush with you as a field guide.
Yeah, I think
how do you envisage people using it?
Well, there's another book coming with Jane Connor. It's just about finished. It's a companion volume, but small and to be taken into the bush. So I think the idea is that people will take the smaller version, and then if they get to know some of the trees and would like to know more, then they can go to the big book.
And it's a tribute in many ways. I felt the award was almost an award to the idea of the book because, you know, I'm sure you're aware publishers are living in desperate times in many ways. But and this was described, I think, on the dust jacket as a once-in-a-generation production book.
Yeah.
You know, the great fear would be that the next generation wouldn't be given the opportunity to make a book of this size and scale. I mean, clearly you were given a huge amount of support from your publisher for this.
Oh, yes, yeah. I mean, the idea of it was Jane Connors, who's, she's, in fact, we've done two books that she suggested. The other was, I think it was Lifestyles of New Zealand Forest Plants, which has sold very well too, and that's a take. But that's all aspect with animals as well in the native forest, although I don't know all that much about but that went in, and of course the interactions between plants and animals, and so that book's been successful. And then Jane had this idea of a really big grand production, so and I think both Rob and I have decided that this is our last book. This is book number 7 in my retirement.
Well, it's a good way to go out.
Yes, that's right.
Well, John, thanks very much for your time.
Yeah.